Thank you to HelloFresh for supporting Current Geek today. Receive $30 off your first week of deliveries when you go to HelloFresh.com and use the offer code CURRENTGEEK30. That's HelloFresh.com and the code CURRENTGEEK30.
Don Corleone, I am honored and grateful that you have invited me to your daughter's wedding on the day of your daughter's wedding. And I hope that their first child be a masculine child.
I have
Current Geek!
Current Geek!
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to Current Geek, the weekly proceedings of the meetings of the Frog Pants All-Stars. But not today! Today's
almost
different.
Almost missed the cue.
Oh, yeah. It's all right. We're doing something a little bit different today, so I don't even know if we need that so much. We probably have to have a whole new kind of intro for what we're about to experiment with. So Tom had this brilliant idea. That's Tom Merritt, everybody. I'm Scott Johnson. Hi. Hello. Tom had this great idea. He says, hey, Scott, why don't we take the best movies ever made, and we'll make that judgment based on a few data points, and we'll kind of average those and figure out what those are on the average. And then why don't we watch those and then discuss them on the show occasionally. Not every week, obviously, but like a thing maybe once a month or whatever it ends up being. It's a little bit of an experiment today, so we're really glad you're here to have this experiment with us. Ironically enough, though, it turns out a lot of the movies considered to be classics are movies I haven't seen. And I don't know why. Like, I don't know why I haven't seen Godfather, which we're going to talk about today. I don't know why I haven't seen Citizen Kane or Casablanca, your favorite movie.
Ooh, that one still hurts.
I know. It hurts me to say it. Like, it's on a I have a list of shame, and it is longer than I'd like. I'd mentioned before in conversation with you, I don't know if it was on the air, but I think one of my problems is, for me, movies started in my youth and from then forward. And so anything older than that felt like grandpa movies to me. So I didn't have the appreciation for things that happened in the early 70s or the late 60s or the 40s or the 50s or any of that, because in my mind that was grandpa's entertainment and I was way cooler than that. And I had Back to the Future and Star Wars and Indiana Jones and all that. So now as a mature adult, I've seen the error in my ways, but it still means there's this backlog of things that I never really paid attention to. And one of those is The Godfather. Now, Tom, how did you come to the conclusion that The Godfather should be numero uno for today?
Yeah, so what I did, because my approach to this is I took a film class in college, and that kind of is what got me to avoid the future you talk about, because I think it would have been the same for me.
Yeah.
But they made me watch a lot of movies that I wouldn't have watched, Kurosawa movies and stuff. And that started me to want to investigate these other old movies that I had missed. And yet there are a bunch of these that I haven't seen either, just because, hey, guess what? There's only so much time. So you know what I've never seen? Schindler's List.
Oh my gosh. Okay. There's one I got you on. All right.
Yeah, I know. Right. Like, how have I not seen, I feel like I've seen it. I know that feeling where people have, like, I feel like I've seen The Godfather, even though I haven't, because everybody quotes it so much.
Sure.
So I was like, well, let's have an excuse to watch these movies as geeks. They don't have to be geeky movies, but they are great movies, and we all love to watch movies and chat about them. Again, not as film experts, not as movie experts, but as people who are, like, just into stuff.
Right.
How do they impact us now? So I created an average of rankings. This is where it gets geeky. I took the top 100 films from Rotten Tomatoes as of May 17th. That's when I made this list.
All right.
I took the top IMDb ratings, and I took the AFI, the American Film Institute's top 100 films, and I created a point system and said, if you're number one on this list, you've got 100 points.
Okay.
If you're number two, you got 99 points.
All right.
And then I averaged those out. Well, I didn't even average them out. I just added them up. And the one with the most points is at the top. Actually, I say that, I kind of cheated. I said, if you're number one, you have 1 point. Mm. And then if you're number two, you have 2 points. And then I added them all up. And then the one with the lowest number actually is at the top of the list. But The Godfather, not the top of the AFI list. The AFI list, I believe, has Citizen Kane at the top. But The Godfather ended up being the lowest scoring by averaging out these three lists, followed by Casablanca, Citizen Kane, Psycho, Sunset Boulevard, The Wizard of Oz, Rear Window, Schindler's List, Singing in the Rain, and All About Eve. Mm. And it goes on. Now, there's some geeky movies down here. Star Wars Episode 4 is number 15 on our list. E.T. is number 18 on the list. Okay. So I think that was one of the keys to putting IMDb and Rotten Tomatoes in here, is to make it not just be an insular film school list, but to combine that kind of stuff with the more widely respected popular stuff.
Yeah, which I think is an awesome idea. So I approve of the method. Now to the madness. The movie itself that we're talking about today is The Godfather, 1972's Godfather, directed by Francis Ford Coppola, written by Mario Puzo, and Francis Ford Coppola worked on the screenplay. That screenplay based on the Puzo novel, and stars Marlon Brando, Al Pacino, James Caan, and a litany of other people we can get into at some point or another in here. I'm a big fan of mob movies. I think Goodfellas is one of the best things ever made. I have seen many, many, many movies that you would call mob or gangster movies, but I never saw what is considered to be, without meaning to make this sound like a pun, the godfather of them all. The Godfather. And yeah. I haven't seen Godfather 2, which ranks up there pretty equally with 1, is from what I hear and see.
Yeah, it's in the top 20 of our combined list here, for sure.
Yeah, and then 3 I never saw. I know 3 is not thought of as highly, but the entire series just completely went past me. However, what I did experience growing up and as an adult was constant references to Godfather stuff in everything. Like, all of pop culture's got something in there to do with The Godfather. I can't watch an episode of Futurama without possibly the Donbot and the robot mafia being on there. And they are all stereotypes, one way or the other, based on Godfather characters. And words, phrases like sleeping with the fishes and others I can't think of off the top of my head. But those are so ingrained into that kind of like this comical impression of what a Italian mob boss is, that in a weird way, I approached this movie and kind of got it the other direction. Cause I'd heard these things before. Like, I'd heard Jerry Seinfeld, an episode of Seinfeld, doing his impression of Marlon Brando saying, "You massacred my boy." And they all make fun of Jerry for having this terrible impression. Well, that's the only reference I had. So when I saw the actual scene, it's impossible for me to see it completely in a vacuum outside of all these other influences. So I kind of wish I was you in this case, because you got to see this before it became the, you know, the meme machine, well, is what it is.
Yes and no. Even when I saw it, I'm trying to guess. I don't remember exactly when I saw it, but I saw it when I was in college. So it was probably 89 or 90,
yeah.
Right? So yeah, no meme machine on the internet at that point, but there was still a lot of stuff I'm like, oh, that's where that comes from, right? It was already in the 70s even, pervasive in our culture. You know, it was one of those movies that instantly people were quoting and talking about and making fun of in a respectful way, I think, in an homage kind of way, because when he says, you know, you come to me on this, the day of my daughter's wedding, I was like, oh, the quote's wrong. I remember that being my first my first impression, because I had always heard before I saw the movie, like, you come to me on this, the day of my daughter's wedding, asking a favor. And then I found out, like, that's not what he says.
Yeah.
He says, you come into my house on the day of my my daughter is to be married, and you ask me to do murder for money. And then several lines later says, someday, and that day may never come, I will call upon you to do a service for me. He doesn't use the word favor. So it was one of those things where I thought I knew the lines because I'd heard them parodied so many times. And the parodies are like, no, that's not actually what he says. Very similar. This happens to Shakespeare a lot, where people say, you know, there's method in his madness. Well, that's not the line from Shakespeare. The line is, though this be madness, there is method in it, right?
So much better too, the way you said it there, the way he said it. So,
and I feel like that's a fair comparison to compare The Godfather to Shakespeare, because there is an essentialness to its lines that allows us to paraphrase them and still retain their power. And I don't think, unless you saw it first run in the theater, that you came to it pure. because it is so ingrained in our culture.
Yeah, I think it's almost impossible to do it. I mean, even when it was contemporary of things like SNL, which was brand new in the 70s, they were doing parodies of it, and people were putting cotton in their cheeks to try to sort of pull off the Marlon Brando thing. So it's hard for me to watch Marlon Brando do the thing everyone parodies without seeing it as a bit of a parody. And I know that that's not true, but that's how I see it, because that's the only, you know, that's the only connection I've had to it up until now. And
well, and it's funny, because I want to make this point before we get too far deep into this. It's not the first mob movie.
No,
there was the Brotherhood. There's all the James Cagney movies, but it definitely felt like the pinnacle of them.
Mm-hmm.
It was the first one where you took the Don seriously. He didn't act the way James Cagney did in all the shoot 'em up ones of the 30s, 40s, and 50s. And yet he played the, you know, sleeps with the fishes. That's something Cagney said all the time, mm-hmm. but it is delivered here with a weight and a meaning. It's like, oh, you know, that's what that fish wrapped in paper means, in such a way that you feel like, oh, I'm seeing what those movies should have been. And every movie since then, Goodfellas, Scarface, they all in some way have their roots in this movie.
Yeah, it feels like, I agree with that. And I think that bears mentioning or looking at a little closer. There are certain films or certain artistic endeavors in general that when they put their stakes down, it's impossible to not acknowledge them or be in their shadow, maybe from then forward. This feels like one of those movies. So even coming into it late and having not seen it, I knew enough about it, knew enough about James Caan's, the way he ended up dying, or the horse head in the bed, or any of these other things that are so iconic from the movie. I knew of them and knew enough of them to know that this movie had an edge to it. And like you said, it had more weight. That holds up, like, surprisingly well. This is a movie from 1972. You and I were toddlers.
Yeah.
And yet
my mom wouldn't let me see it when I was 2.
Oh, yeah. I remember she was really insistent on that. Yeah. You're only 2. You can't see it, she'd say.
Godfather.
In fact, I remember being told when I was like 12 that I couldn't watch it on like VHS or whatever. So yeah, my, you know, there it retained some of that edge, but it's, that stuff held up pretty well, surprisingly. It doesn't contain the kinds of things I associate with 70s quote unquote action or dramas, like zoom in cameras. That's not in this. It's a very subtle approach. Like, the hold up atness of it is strong with this one. And I think that's partially why it is such a point of light for everything that has come since. And Scorsese and Coppola were contemporaries of each other. And the fact that Coppola would establish this as the de facto mob movie, and then later Scorsese would redefine it even further with things like Goodfellas, things like Casino, many others I'm not thinking of right now. In many ways, Scorsese now kind of owns that space, but it's impossible to even think about his movies without thinking about the Godfather series. Not to mention the fact that there are a bunch of shared actors, and, you know, De Niro and Pacino, and these people tend to show up in everybody's movies. De Niro's, of course, in the second one. I don't know if he's in the third. I don't think he is. But anyway, it's important to note that, I think, in our discussion, because we're going to run into this a lot, I think. We're going to run into war movies that are considered the best of all time, and we're going to figure out why. You know, why is it that, say, I don't know, I can't think of a good one, Guns of Navarone was so important, or why was Schindler's List so important as a Holocaust film? There are reasons behind that, and I think we can maybe explore some of those today when it comes to The Godfather.
Yeah, and as I said, I mean, we're going to be approaching this not as like, here's the inside scoop or the history or anything like that. We're just going to be giving our impressions of these movies. But I mean, just in the course of watching this stuff, I tend to want to look things up.
Mm-hmm.
And I noticed Al Pacino, particularly, this is the first big break for him, right? He's been in a few movies before this, but after this, suddenly now he is Al Pacino. Yep. And you kind of see that happen in the movie. When he first shows up on screen, he barely looks like Al Pacino, right? You're like, oh, I guess that's a young Al Pacino. It kind of looks like any other guy that age. And he's just, you know, he's a nice guy and doesn't, you know, he's trying not to hide what his family does, but letting Kay know, like, you know, this is not me. Yeah. And you think that's where that story is going to go. And then, of course, in a way, this is a Breaking Bad story.
Yeah.
Because over the course of the movie, you see him become Michael Corleone, the Don of the crime family. But you also, I feel like you see him become Al Pacino by the end when he is in that office and he's presiding over everything. You're like, oh yeah, that's Scarface. That's Al Pacino. That's who I'm going to get to know right there.
Yeah. Even little things like the voice you associate with Al Pacino, the high cheekbones, saggy, sort of droopy eyes, Al Pacino-ness of Al Pacino. These things come out later in the movie. And in the beginning, he looks like this young Boy Scout. In fact, I thought, how the crap does that become Al Pacino? His voice is different. It's lighter. It's higher. Now I think it's maybe a piece of genius because it's the same movie that was getting shot. It isn't like he aged 10 years and then they went back and finished it up while he was the Don. Like, he makes a transformation in both his character, but also the actor, I think, in a way that would establish what he was going to do for the next, well, maybe even till now, you know, with a few exceptions like Scent of a Woman or perhaps others.
Adam Sandler movie.
Sure. Something like that. For the most part, this defines who that dude is. And he's maybe the best we ever had or ever have, you know, have had up to this point in this kind of role. And he ate it up toward the end of that movie. Like, he went from that Boy Scout and the return from the war uniform to this monster who's got full control over the family business, has wrestled it back away from those who would take it from them, establishes the new norm moving forward into the what would be the 80s and 90s, or I guess in their timeline it'd be the 50s and 60s.
Yeah, this goes through 55, I think.
Right. And so I think I said 90s because I was thinking 3 was made in the 90s, but it was about them living in the 60s, I think. Mm-hmm. But anyway, that's really impressive, and it's visual and it's visceral, and his transformation is noteworthy. In fact, there's a little controversy about that. So I had always heard about Marlon Brando winning Best Actor for his role and him having, instead of him going up there, refusing to go, and as an act of protest, he had somebody representing him, and it was Sachin Littlefeather was her name. She is a Native American Californian actress, had her go up there, and she had a prepared speech, and it was all about the wounded knee stuff and, you know, wanted to make a point. So I thought that was the controversy of the 1972-73 Oscars, and that's all there was wrote. But what I didn't know was that Best Supporting Actor nominations went to Al Pacino as one of them, Robert Duvall and James Caan being the other two from the movie. And he wouldn't go, did not attend the ceremony in protest, not because of wounded knee, not because of any kind of other thing like that. It's because he thought it was category fraud. So from what I can understand, he was ticked that because he had more screen time than Brando, he should have been considered in the same category as Brando.
Yeah.
And we're talking about Marlon Brando, which is, right, you know, the biggest dude ever at the time. So, you know, competing in that category would have been crazy.
At the same time, though, who is the lead actor? Who is this the story of? Who's sitting in the office at the end of this story? And you know that it's going to focus on him in part two.
Mm-hmm.
It's freaking Michael Corleone. I mean, Vito Corleone is there to set up Michael.
Yeah,
this is Michael's story, because that moment when he is sitting in the chair, and up till that point, it's always been like, well, Michael knows what's going on, but keep him out of direct involvement because, you know, he's the good one. And you get that great conversation later where Vito says, I wanted you to become a senator, which, like, seriously, with even if he didn't have his hands dirty, you as his relative would definitely have prevented him from being a senator. But he wanted better things for Michael. And that moment where he's sitting in that chair and they're trying to figure out what to do, and Vito's out of the picture, and Sonny is the oldest and he's trying to lead, but you just see Michael just knows what to do.
Yeah, no, totally.
And at that moment, you know, okay, this is his story.
Yeah.
He is the agent of change. And I can see where Al Pacino would be like, come on, the lead character of The Godfather is Michael Corleone. Yes, Vito Corleone is right there next to him as either a co-lead or the most important assistant character or supporting character. But you can't call Michael Corleone a supporting role.
Yeah, I kind of agree with you, and I agree with him. I don't know that I would have protested it, but maybe I would have. It's kind of a big deal, I suppose. But yeah, I think he kind of got robbed. The movie is subtle at that, though. Like, to the credit of the movie, number one, you got the maybe one of the best, if not the best, performances out of Marlon Brando you've ever seen. So he is really good in it. It's also kind of toward the end of his career. Not toward the end of his career. He had plenty more to do, but he was 47 years old. He, you know, had kind of done all the big things he was going to do, and who knew what the future was. So it feels like a little bit of Hollywood finally giving him his due sort of thing, even though he'd won some previous awards. But the movie itself is subtle. It's like Michael Corleone comes home from the war, and then we don't think much about it. In fact, we're thinking more of James Caan's character or the other brothers, and we're not really thinking about him so much. We know something's up. I thought he was going to be, in my head, I know what happens because I, you know, the other two movies exist. So I kind of knew, but in my head, as I'm watching it, trying to experience it for the first time, pretend I know nothing about this movie the way you do of Star Wars. I had it in my head, he might be like a tragic figure in this. Like,
yeah,
he would end up being killed or would die because he's got these more high-minded ideals and they don't match that with the family and so on. And it just so subtly, I mean, there's definitely a turning point, but it's so very subtle how they move him into the front that I could see why maybe it could happen where he didn't get the credit he maybe deserved. Yeah. So,
no, I think it mostly had to do with what you said, which is like, he's Marlon F. and Brando, right? Like,
yeah.
we're not gonna set him up not to win.
Yeah.
Even though maybe after the protest they regretted that decision, I don't know, but it really is an interesting situation and a really interesting story, because as you said, you don't quite realize that Michael's the center at first. It is a Breaking Bad story, because he is also telling himself a story about being good the entire time as well, to the point where he ends up just flat out lying to Kay at the end, and not blinking an eye.
Yeah. Which I think Eileen,
when he was like in that situation, right, where he's trying to figure out what to do, and then he starts lying to her, and he has had, Carlo murdered, right? Cold blood.
Right.
Eileen's like, he had a good relationship with his father, right? And I'm like, yeah, no, you saw it. His father loved him. He loved his father. You know, they had a great relationship. This was not a lack of love situation. And I find that to be, because the easy out is to be like, oh, it was a cold crime boss and I never got the love from my father. No, they make a point. Coppola makes a point of saying Vito Corleone is a family man. He says it's important to spend time with your family. Anyone who doesn't spend time with your family isn't a man.
Yeah.
And so you have to be like, well, where does this come from?
Mm-hmm.
It's not the easy answer of, you know, wanting the approval of his parents.
Yeah,
for sure. This comes from being around this family, from being around crime your entire life. And it just warps your sense of what's real.
Yeah. Plus the movie's good at this. He's this, like you said, Vito has higher ideas for what his son might become. He does have that good relationship with him. I think he already kind of knew that his brother, played by James Caan, was kind of a butthole and was, you know, and could run the family, but would just, his temper would get in the way. And like, he's a bit of a stereotype anyway, but.
And everybody knew Fredo was useless.
Yeah, and Fredo's worth, you know, what's Fredo doing? He's not great. So I think what he thought is, all right, well, this will be the son that I can send in a much more legitimate direction. I can keep him away from the violence or whatever. And in the beginning he was, and even said, I'm not the same as my family. I'm different. And the truth was he really wasn't all that different, or he couldn't necessarily be that different, because at some point you realize you're just kind of trapped in the cycle and there's no way to get out of it. To top that off, you know that the only way to truly get revenge for your dad is to kill the guys responsible for shooting him in the first place.
Well, and that's the other thing I love is it's not just revenge.
Yeah.
And there's that great scene where the consigliere, where Tom is saying, like, this is just business. It's not personal. I love how Sonny always does the, like, the thing that he gets criticized for and then immediately turns around and says, it's business. It's not personally. He does it at the dinner table, too, mm-hmm. where they're like, remember, we used to not talk business at the table. He's like, shut up. And then Carlos speaks up. He's like, hey, we don't talk business at the table. It's a great little personality quirk. There's so many cool things about this movie that are like that, these little pieces that let you know, oh, that's who Sonny is. But I love that you know, when Sonny is being told this is business, not personal, you know that Michael is saying, we really need to do this. Yes, I'm mad, and yes, I do want vengeance, but the reason we need to do this is to stop them coming after his father. Mm. And you hear him say that several times in the car ride, at the dinner table. I feel like that Coppola and Puzo were trying to tell us that Michael really didn't want to kill them. He was hoping he could get assurance that they would stop coming after his father, because that's all he wanted. He just wanted to protect his father. Mm-hmm. And he realized this is the only way to protect him. Yeah. There's no other way.
And the last moments we get of him having that more pure approach is when he's at the hospital and he's asking the nurse to help move him. He's still got that voice. He still has that innocence. He still has that sense of, you know, we just need to make this right or whatever. And then that all just sort of gets taken away. And that's fascinating to watch. Like, that's when the character breaks bad. It's like for Walter White, it was cancer was the impetus, and that's what changed everything. For him, it was, you know, shedding of blood and the attempted murder of his father, and realizing that everybody's ruthless and wants their own thing, and the only way to get what you need or to retain some sense of family is to protect them any way possible, and that includes murder, lying, getting into the drug business, blah, 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 all the way down the line. And that's fun to watch. Like, fun to watch him descend in that regard and find yourself rooting for him, even though he's really, you know, he's not going away that you really want your friend to go. Like,
no.
I don't want to root for him so much.
I mean, every decision he makes, you get, though.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. No, it all makes sense. I mean, I guess maybe that's, everyone always talks about what a brilliant script it is.
Mm-hmm.
I was unprepared for the amount of nuance we got. I thought it would be a lot of, oh no, they've ambushed a guy and he's dead. Now the other family wants revenge. Like, I had all these little basic plot twists that everyone does in my head, and it's deeper than that. There's more to it than that. And that was really fun to watch.
It's a great script, because even the obvious things are presented in a way that seem natural.
Yeah.
Where they're not done because they're obvious, like, well, we will now get revenge because that's what you do. They were worked through. There were arguments. And things like the sound design just made things feel natural.
Mm-hmm.
When you're in the family's house, there's no like, okay, everybody quiet down so we can hear the actors' lines. Kids are shouting and people are practicing trumpets, and it's like a real house,
mm-hmm.
right? Where you can't get a word in edgewise, and everybody's. In fact, there's one scene in particular. I think it's the scene where they're having the negotiation for the first time, and they're in sort of like a, I don't know if it's a. It looks like an American Legion hall, and I know it's not, but it's something like that.
Yeah.
And Sollozzo is there.
Yeah.
You hear like kids practicing basketball through the wall.
Yeah. It's like right? The YMCA, like, next door or something.
If you want to go for drama, you have this dead, silent, abandoned back room, right? The smoky back room. But instead they're like, no, these guys met in a rec center. Make it sound like a rec center.
Yeah, no, totally. And I love that. I like those little details are great. Also, one of the first movies I can think of that's from this time where music is not used at certain points that it would have been traditionally in almost every other movie before it. Mm-hmm. When there is a big shootout in an Italian restaurant in the Cagney years, they don't just use the sounds of the yells and the shots and the screaming. They use music to punctuate everything. And this didn't do that. It got quiet. The deaths felt more grisly that way. It reminded me very much of No Country for Old Men, a movie that has no soundtrack really to speak of. And the same effect is there. So what you have is a less glorification or a less Hollywoodification of a death, and more of a real visceral, oh my gosh, you just shot that guy in the neck while he was eating and he didn't know you had a gun because you found it in the bathroom moment. That is so much more impactful, so much more hardcore, than if they would have tried to put some sweeping score behind it. And that really works for me for whatever. The lack of sound sometimes is my favorite kind of sound. And this movie was really good at just letting sounds be sounds. And I was surprised there was some ADR after the fact voiceover stuff, because all movies do. Surprisingly not, you know, lots of on-set audio, not a lot of go back in the studio and redo it because we couldn't hear you. Like, they just let some of that stuff go and let some of the ambient sound happen, and it made it more tense, and you felt nervous during scenes where it was just chaos because there's kids and phones and ladies and people and talking, and James Caan's finding out his sister's been wronged again and he's getting out of there. And that guy, man, he was great. I freaking love James Caan in this. I always liked James Caan, but he's always been kind of quiet, sort of standing there to me. Not in this. He's like,
no.
He's been eating his sugar or whatever. plenty of energy coming out of James Caan. But you know what I'm saying? Like, it must have been on purpose, but there's this very deliberate, visceral lack of normal Hollywood tropes when, other than the ones they established, because it's also impossible to watch this and not go, oh, there's that thing that they probably did first, and now a million other movies have tried to kind of do that idea. Kind of like it used to be really unique when Scorsese would have their main characters, like in Goodfellas or something, narrate the entire film, which mm-hmm. I love the way he does it. He's so good at it. But when other people do it, I go, oh, they're just doing Scorsese. And so he became his own kind of trope, but he's the originator of it. Pulp Fiction, similar thing. I feel like a lot of people tried to Pulp Fictionize stuff after Tarantino. So you know, here there's another case of this movie doing some things first that now feel like tropes, even though they're, you know, it deserves full credit for them. Hey guys, busting in here real quick to talk about today's sponsor, which is HelloFresh.com. I love HelloFresh.com, the meal delivery kit service that makes cooking more fun, so you can focus on the whole experience, not just the final plate. Each week, HelloFresh creates new and delicious recipes with step-by-step instructions. The recipes are set up so that anybody can make a delicious and nutritious home-cooked meal in 30 minutes or less. Whether you usually cook for yourself or you're not so comfortable with it, now's the time. HelloFresh sources the freshest ingredients measured to the exact quantities that you need, no food waste, and everything's delivered to your doorstep in a recyclable insulated box. Less than $10 a meal is how much the service costs, which is amazing. I have teamed up with HelloFresh.com, and they're offering everybody in the Current Geek audience $30 off your first week of deliveries when you go to HelloFresh.com and use the offer code CurrentGeek30. I have really, really enjoyed every meal that I've ever gotten. It's also so simple to unbox and get ready. And you'd think, oh man, how are these ingredients? They're supposed to be fresh. How are they going to be fresh? And they always are. They really take care of everything, and it's amazing. So go for it. HelloFresh.com and the code CurrentGeek30 for $30 off your first week of deliveries. You shall not disappoint yourselves.
The thing that impressed me watching it yesterday was the things that feel like tropes. Mm. When you see them in The Godfather, you feel like you're looking at the original.
Yeah.
Right. It's like when you've looked at, reproductions of the Constitution all your life. And then you go to Washington, D.C. and you go to the museum and you're like, oh, that's what the real one looks like.
Yeah.
It's bigger. It's a little more gnarled, you know, and that's what I felt like with The Godfather. It's like, oh, yeah, this is the trope where the Don of the crime family does this. Man, this feels like the real one.
Yeah.
Not the ripoff. Everything else, and not even a ripoff, but this is the template.
Yeah. And a lot of these, one other thing I noticed, a lot of these actors are all in their element. They work with him a lot. A lot of these same people were in Apocalypse Now, and had done other work together and so on. And for the most part, I see them and go, oh, Marlon Brando, there's Al Pacino. Check out James Caan, young, but that's James Caan for sure. There's Robert Duvall. I can't yeah. miss him. A couple times, though, totally surprised. The examples I would give, Diane Keaton as Kay Adams.
Yeah.
Unrecognizable as Diane Keaton. I had no idea.
So young.
Yeah.
And not Annie Hall.
No. Right? No, not at all. In fact, if anything, Annie Hall, not that it hurt her career. Obviously, she's had an incredible career, and she's awesome, and I love her. but she's kind of the Annie Hall character forever now.
Yeah.
Like, straight up.
I think Annie Hall was a little bit her, whereas Kay is not Diane Keaton, would be my guess.
No. In fact, I didn't know it was her. I kept saying, I thought she was in this. Where is she? And I thought, well, maybe she has to be her. Like, the blonde lady's the only one close enough to looking like her, and sure enough, it was her.
Well, so, and we were talking about how Al Pacino doesn't feel like Al Pacino at first, right, and he has the higher voice. I feel like that's kind of part of what's going on with Kay Adams, is that she doesn't feel like Diane Keaton because she's a young innocent, but her character stays that way.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the tension now, is like, ooh, but she's in love and now married to the dawn of a crime family, and she knows it.
Mm-hmm.
But she's trying to keep her innocent. Oh, well, you don't kill people, right? No, honey, of course not.
Well, all of the talk, speaking of cast in the past, was that I would get a ton of Abe Vigoda in this.
Yes.
And he's surely in this, but he's not.
And he has a pivotal role, right?
A very pivotal role, but it's also small. Like, I kind of wished, maybe it's just the Sopranos lover in me, which, again, that show borrows heavily from this source material. But one of my favorite things about The Sopranos is the henchmen were some of my favorite characters, the guys that were kind of the second in charge or the people Tony trusted. And they were in this movie. Those kinds of characters existed, maybe mostly in the character of Tom Hagen with Robert Duvall. But I guess I wanted a little more of those secondary guys. And maybe that's a place where, you know, The Sopranos built on this and made something, you know, even better. But it bummed me out a little bit. I wanted more Abe Vigoda.
More fish.
Yeah, more fish. More of it. Bigger fish.
Bigger part for the fish. Not sleeping with the fish. But, well, no, I noticed that too, because Abe Vigoda is one of those people that stands out as Abe Vigoda. He definitely looks like Abe Vigoda the whole way through, and he's definitely Abe Vigoda every time he talks. Mm-hmm. But he does a great job as Tessio. And because you know he's Abe Vigoda, he does stick out in the background.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh, there he is. There's Tessio. When's he talk? Like, yeah. I couldn't remember when he actually, like, popped up. And you're right, it's very late in the movie, because Clemenza, Richard Castellano's character, kind of gets the majority of the attention. Even though they talk about Clemenza and Tessio in equal terms, Clemenza is the one you see doing things most of the
Clemenza
time.
Is doing all the hits, which gives him a much bigger stage. He's fun to watch. I always like a good hitman in my mob movies. That guy's great for that. The guy who played the owner of the casino, I'm going to find his name real fast.
Oh, the guy who played Mo Green?
Yeah, Mo Green, as portrayed, can't find it. Dang it. Anyway, that guy is in a million things, and it drove me crazy. This is what happens in a modern context when we watch movies now. I got to have a second screen.
Alex Rocco.
There you go. That guy. I have to look this dude up. I got to dig up all the things I've seen him in, and it turns out he has been in a ton of stuff. Like, everything from episodes of, you know, Fantasy Island to other real crappy 80s TV to other great movies. Like, that guy's in everything. And I was having a lot of fun with this movie, picking these people out and going, oh, yeah, I've seen that other guy in other things. What's weird to me is how much older these actors seem, even though they are really young in this. Al Pacino is a freaking young buck in this, but he still seems... I can't think of Al Pacino.
Marlon Brando is our age when he did this movie. They make him older for the part.
Yeah.
But he's not even that old at this point.
I think it's because everybody smoked then. That's my theory. Smoke,
well,
smoke,
okay.
Smoke.
What about Connie? You know who Connie is also, right?
Hold on. Oh, yeah. She's Rocky's wife. Right?
Adrian!
Yeah.
and she looks older than Adrian to me.
Yeah.
In this movie.
Yeah.
And I don't mean that in a pejorative way. I mean, she just looks more mature. She looks like a grown-up, whereas Adrian always looks kind of young, like a little bit innocent.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, I mean, I think part of it is the style of the time. It's one of the things that helps The Godfather be a timeless movie, is that it is a period piece.
Mm-hmm.
So it doesn't stick out as like, oh, yes, this is definitely made in 1972, because they're trying to make it look like 1946 and 1955 and whatnot. But I think that also helps, because those time periods always just make people look older, no matter how old they are.
Now, a couple fun things about the story that threw me off. I knew about the horse, and I knew it was in a bed, and there's been a million jokes about it. It's a great Simpsons episode where they do this with, I can't remember why, something with the mobster guys in the Simpsons. Anyway, the head thing, famous scene. When I finally get to see it for real, which was this viewing, I went, oh, that's like a real freaking horse head. Like, that's not like some, you know, crappy 1972 prosthetic or something.
They didn't saw it off the merry-go-round.
No.
At the kids' park. No.
No, they did not. I mean, I don't, some of the blood may have been fake, but it looked like a real head to me. So, of course, I had to go down a rabbit hole. Like, a three-hour movie like this takes me 6 hours, I swear, because I have to look up so much stuff. But, so apparently here's the skinny on this thing. Animal rights activists were ticked. They were protesting the use of the horse's head. He told Variety magazine, here's some actual quotes from Francis Ford Coppola. He says, there were many people killed in this movie, but everyone worries about the horse. It was the same on set. When the head arrived, it upset many crew members who are all animal lovers and who like little doggies. Seems like he's being a little facetious. Mm-hmm. What they don't know is that we got the head from a pet food manufacturer who slaughters 200 horses per day just to feed the dogs. So it's not like they went out and killed a horse and brought the head in, but they got it somewhere that does this stuff all day.
No, I mean, this is what you do. You don't kill a horse. You find out who kills horses and throws away horse heads. And then you say, hey, instead of throwing one of those away, can we have it?
Right. It makes real practical sense, but today you'd never use a real horse head. Like,
no.
You would have a team of great artists making practical effects.
And the argument being that if you create a demand for a real horse head somehow, that's going to encourage people to continue to kill horses.
Right.
So I get it.
Yeah.
But I also get what Coppola was saying is we didn't kill a horse that wasn't going to be killed already.
Yeah. I love
and
that.
Everything is shot on location. Everything is period. It's part of the gestalt of like, no, we're not going to fake a horse. We're going to have a real horse head.
Yeah. None of this felt, nothing felt like even the makeup on maybe the most impressive quote unquote effect in the movie is the makeup on Marlon Brando is totally believable.
Oh, as when he's old, when he's an old man.
Yeah. It's not, yeah. They're not, I mean, he looks the way he, even when he's playing younger and they've added a little bit to his face and mm-hmm. wrinkled up his head a little bit. His swagger, and he just lives in it in a way that is never making me go, oh, where are the seams? I can kind of see some latex. Like, I didn't see any of that. It was really good. Really
impressive. Let's talk a moment about that death scene, too, because that is one of the all-time greatest death scenes.
Yeah.
Because it's not hammed up.
No.
But it is poignant as hell.
Yeah.
The idea of Grandpa messing around with oranges in his mouth, chasing around with the baby. You know, and it's just such a touching scene. Yeah. And then this is how it really happens.
Yeah.
People just fall over, you know, and
people,
that's it.
People die.
And the little boy not really still thinking, oh, Grandpa's playing, you
mm-hmm.
know.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, God, that gets me every time.
And
it got
me here because I think I always watch for this. This wasn't a good 2-year-old actor. What this was a little kid they got to play with. You know, to play. He's playing.
Yeah. No, he's legitimately playing with Marlon Brando.
So when Marlon Brando biffs it,
yeah,
he's still playing because that's what 2-year-olds do, and he doesn't understand. So there's a legitimacy, and it kind of makes it a little creepy, but in the sense that...
Oh, it's way creepy.
Yeah. It's like any of these things. It's like the real head or whatever. It's like you're going for that kind of realism, and it's 1972. Standards were different, but this little kid is potentially traumatized by the face you're making with the orange stuff you're goofing around with. Like, that was real tear in that kid's eyes. Not faking it. It's not acting. And that's hard to do.
I mean,
you know,
I don't want to make too much out of this comparison, but the cat, which is another iconic thing, right? The cat sitting on Don Corleone's lap.
Yeah.
The cat starts batting away at Marlon Brando's hand and meowing, and he just rolls with it.
Yeah.
And, you know, I could see somebody telling Coppola, like, oh, we should probably do another take. And Coppola, like, no, that was brilliant.
Yeah. I think that stuff worked out really well. There was also supposedly, now again, Francis Ford Coppola's storied career of button heads with studio executives and actors who work for him and all this other stuff and how Apocalypse Now barely made it out alive and everyone went crazy on set and blah, blah, blah. There was some friction, according to some trivia I found, between Francis Ford Coppola and Paramount, big shock, in which Paramount frequently tried to have Coppola replaced. They said that he had an inability to stay on schedule, unnecessary expenses, and production and casting errors. The at the end of it all, though, he actually completed the film ahead of schedule and ahead of budget, which is kind mm-hmm. of funny. But I always feel better about my classics when I find out that there was a bunch of resistance. Because for whatever reason, and it happens with him more than most, but for whatever reason, that feels more authentic to me. Because it meant somebody had to fight for a thing. Their vision needed to be seen. They had to do this or else it wasn't going to work or whatever. I may have, a lot of this may just be in my imagination, but Coppola feels like one of those dudes.
Well, okay, so this is just Wikipedia mining. This isn't something I, you know, did deep research, but apparently Paramount wanted to set The Godfather in modern day Kansas City to keep the cost down.
Oh, really?
Can you imagine the God, like this movie is suddenly not good.
Yeah.
If it, the fact that it is in 1940s New York is part of the thing that makes it. I mean, you have to execute on it, but it's like, oh yeah, this is when this was real.
Mm-hmm.
This was when this was not out in Las Vegas. This was the way New York was run. And that theme of narcotics being sort of the new thing on the block that the Dons are like, wow, boy, I don't know if I really want that,
yeah.
You know, and showing the bald racism of like, well, okay, we'll give it to the black people, but not, you know, not to us.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's real. That was the conversation that was happening then. And you said it in modern day Kansas City, even in 1972 Kansas City, it lacks all that punch.
Yeah.
It lacks all that weight.
Yeah, I agree. I like that a lot when they're true to that stuff. And it's hard. In the 70s, movies were kind of bad at this. If they were trying to do a period piece, you'd get everything but the hair right. Like everybody's hair would look like big, you know, beehive looking late 60s, early 70s hairdos. And you just go, ugh, just take me out of it. It's just, this is no good. It doesn't matter how good the town or the cars or anything looks. The people just don't look right.
Yeah.
And it's easy to do.
He actually shot in Sicily too.
Hmm.
And that's the one part where I'm like, you know, that really does look like California. I mean, I know he shot in Sicily. And when you see the buildings,
sure,
that makes it like, okay, yeah, those are definitely Italian villages and Italian buildings. But the scrubgrass, I'm like, you know, that could be over there in Topanga.
Yeah,
I mean, it could.
It's like where they filmed MASH or something.
It's, yeah,
like the
right.
Back hills.
Not
there.
Not that different. I mean, I think if I was a botanist, I probably wouldn't agree, but...
Well, I mean, that was the kind of attention to detail he had, especially at this point in his career.
Yeah.
Now, there's a lot of stinkers late in his career. I don't know if you've seen much well, I liked Bram Stoker's Dracula, so I'm not going to poo-poo on that one. I thought that was great.
I feel a little bit about Bram Stoker's Dracula like I do about Pacific Rim.
Mm.
And I think that says everything for most people. But if you don't know how I feel about Pacific Rim, like, I wanted to see big giant robots beat up on kaiju, and that's what I got. Thank you.
Yeah.
Bram Stoker's Dracula, I was like, you know, I want to see some vampires bite people. And that's what I got.
Yeah, and I want to see some actors ham it up. And I want to I want to see somebody, you know, I want to see Keanu Reeves completely miscast in a movie. I want to see all those things. But, I mean, he directed a couple of comedies. He did Peggy Sue Got Married with...
That's a great
movie. It's a great movie. Like, yeah, it's fun. So, you know, I think he probably... You can't do these kinds of movies for very long before you are just burnt out and you need to move on to lighter fare. And I think that's kind of what we get out of him more recently and certainly now. Like right now, most of his projects I hadn't even heard of. I was looking at a bunch of them trying to figure out what's what and see if there's anything new or cool happening. But it got me to thinking, and here's the question for Tom. Do you think this is a series, it being a trilogy, is it untouchable, or can somebody someday go, you know what, we're remaking The Godfather?
Normally, my answer to this question is, of course, at some point you can remake anything.
Yeah.
And at some point, every story can benefit from a new vision. It may, you know, the jazz singer is an example. The original talkie by the early 1980s was ripe to be turned into a Neil Diamond musical, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it may take a while for it to get to that point. I don't know about The Godfather, though. I mean, I think let's forget about part three. Let's just focus on Godfather and part two.
Yeah.
It's so good. It's so timeless. It wears so well. This is one of those occasions where I would say no.
I
never say never, but I'd say it will be a long, long time before you look at this and say, oh, I'd like to see someone else's take on it.
Sure. I'm going to agree with you because I'm also of that ilk. I when someone says, hey, new Ghostbusters, hey, new whatever, I usually go, great. We'll see how it works. If it's no good, well, then we'll learn and we'll try again later. And if it works, great. If you didn't have that kind of can-do attitude, we wouldn't have new Star Wars movies. We wouldn't have freaking Marvel movies do as well as they do. It's, these things take risks, and I'm totally for them. But I think there may be a handful where we just need to recognize them as kind of untouchable. And if someone does, I mean, what am I going to do to stop it? I guess it will happen, and I'll see it. And if it's good, great. If it's not, oh well. But I think I agree with that. This maybe is one of those where I would be very wary of somebody wanting to do that. It feels too risky on lots of levels. You're going to get all kinds of heat for even trying it. What I'd rather see is very talented directors, producers, writers get together and make movies that, again, borrow from The Godfather. I don't think there are enough period piece mob movies is what I'm getting at. They're just aren't. And
okay.
I love them. I like the idea of a modern setting. It's fine to have your New Jack Cities and your whatevers. But what I want is...
Yeah, even Goodfellas, right, is more modern.
Sure. I mean, that happened in the 70s. Well, started in the late 60s, 70s, and 80s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's a fun period to explore. But what I really want, I want 40s Tommy Gun, Prohibition. Well, that wasn't Prohibition, but you know what I mean? That feel of that time.
I mean, Gangs of New York gives you that.
Yeah. Oh, for sure.
But it's been a while since that. You know, that's the most recent one I can think of off the top of my head. I'm sure there are others, but...
Yeah. I mean, The Departed is one of my favorite mob movies ever, but it's brand... Mm-hmm. I mean, it's set in modern day, basically.
Exactly. It's not a period.
Yeah. I mean, a really good time to spend, I think, is binging on Boardwalk Empire. That show from HBO.
Well, and that's the thing, right? Yeah. Sopranos is what you're talking about.
Yeah.
Although also more modern, obviously. Yeah. But Boardwalk Empire is Scorsese's doing exactly what you said.
Sure.
And I think maybe that's where we're at, is this is a thing for the HBOs and Netflixes of the world to cover.
Sure. And I'm all about my genres being mixed. So if what they want to do is make science fiction, outer space mob movies, I'm into that. I love this.
So like a Futurama spinoff.
Yeah. Yes. Or I want the Hutts spinoff movie from Star Wars.
I hate the Hutts.
The Hutts suck. And I'm not saying I want it to be the main character as a slug.
Big slugs. That just ruins it for me.
But it could just be around that crime world. You know what I mean?
Maybe like, you do a, what's Grand Admiral Thrawn's race?
Oh,
I never remember it, but
blue.
Maybe their race has a crime syndicate that they're fighting.
Smurf.
So you just take it out of the mainstream.
But yeah, he's a Smurf.
You know, there's a Star Wars connection here that I discovered.
Oh.
The reason that Coppola agreed, he apparently called The Godfather by Puzo kind of cheap stuff. He didn't want to do it.
Yeah.
But he needed the money.
Right.
And the reason he needed the money is that American Zoetrope owed Warner Brothers $400,000 for budget overruns on THX-1138.
Oh, there's your connection then.
Yeah.
Not bad. Well, it really paid off. He made one of the best movies ever made. It won Best Picture. It won Best Actor. And it took home a bunch of nominations for other stuff, as well as Best Writing. Like, it is... Can you imagine a world where he was like, I don't want to do it, and he didn't do it? Like, that's crazy.
Yeah.
Like, I can't imagine a world without The Godfather, especially now having seen it. And I already felt that before seeing it. So its impact is notable. Before we get out of here, I think we should give it a in the context of we're watching these classic movies for these occasional episodes, we need to give it some kind of scale or rating within that context. I don't know what that should be. Should be a number? Should be a... I don't know. I have no idea.
I mean, this is as close to a perfect movie.
Yeah.
In so many ways. If you were going to say scale of 10, I'd probably say something like 9.8.
Yeah.
Because because nothing's perfect.
Yeah.
You know, there's that one part where you could tell it was 80 yard. you know?
Yeah.
Like you could pick on anything if you really want. But man, it's so good.
Yeah. James Caan beating up what's his name in the street with the garbage can scene is kind of a badly choreographed fight scene. Like you could see.
Oh, him. Yeah. There's one point where you clearly misses.
Yeah. It's all pretty bad. But it's not enough for me to take it out of the 9 point something range. It's that important, that good.
Maybe we set this. How about this? We set it as the template.
Okay.
The Godfather is the rating. We give the Godfather one Godfather. And then from now on, it's like, is this 0.8 of a Godfather? Is it 0.6 of a Godfather?
Yeah.
Is it a whole Godfather? Is it two Godfathers? Is anything that good?
Two and a half vetoes. There you go. See?
Yeah.
Well, that sounds like veto. We don't want that.
Yeah. Or anyway. We could call it 100 Krolls.
Yeah. It could be. Yeah, you take a small, it's like going to pesos or yen.
We could have an exchange system.
That's crazy. All right. We don't know what our next one is, but we may be asking for some votes in some various ways, so we'll be doing that.
Yeah. The next one on the list is Casablanca. So if we just went reverse order, that would be the next one.
Yeah.
And maybe that's what we'll do next. But yeah, we thought about maybe asking folks who subscribe to the Current Geek Box to weigh in somehow. Yeah. Maybe we'll give you, limited options based on what we've got coming up. So we'll let you know about that.
Something will come in the mail perhaps with your next box or something. But if we do Casablanca, there's another movie where we all think we know the line, but it's not the same, right?
Play it, Sam. You played it for her. You can play it for me.
Yeah, not play it again, Sam.
Yep.
It doesn't exist. It's so weird. What's that? The Mandela effect.
Our troubles
effect.
Don't amount to a hill of beans.
It's the Mandela effect. It's Berenstein or Steinbears. Yeah. It's the same deal. So, anyway.
I love that movie so much. I've seen it so many times.
I am so excited to see that because I don't know what to expect from it at all. Because I don't have any point of reference other than that line, which is not even correct. Bogey looking all smoky and dark black and white. It's all I know. So this is going to be real fun. We don't know when this will be. We'll give you guys a date. I mean, I really like the once a month idea, so we're probably working on that.
Yeah, and so let us know, just on Twitter or anywhere, chat room, what you think of this. Did you like this episode? Would you like to see us do this more often?
Yeah, I would really like to hear that. In the meantime, we still persist and exist over there at currentgeek.com, where you'll find all of our details to contact us, find us, and all that stuff. We will be back next week with a brand new show with guests. Thank you guys for listening, and we'll see you then.
This show is part of the Frog Pants Network.
Frog Pants Network.
Get more shows like this at frogpants.com.